My name is John Sperney. I'm a musician, composer, and producer in New York City.
Okay, so I'm going to start with, you know, this kind of construction of a question, and then we'll work around it after that. But, you know, John, if you were invited as a musician and composer into a high school class and charged with the responsibility of communicating something important to them about the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper, where do you think you'd start? And maybe if you only had 10 minutes, you know, what would leap to the top of your presentation about talking about this particular record?
Well, I think the most important thing, I mean, if I was going to distill down the importance of Sgt. Pepper for a 10-minute presentation to high school students, I would just say it's kind of the first moment where rock music becomes considered as art. You know, it's music made for the sake of pure listening. It's no longer kind of ritualistic tribal dance music for teenagers to aid in their mating rituals, you know. It's like self-conscious art that is made to be listened to and digested and taken seriously. And it's now something that we all take for granted. You know, people are so pretentious about their musical productions. But, you know, before Pepper, pop music was an incredibly disposable form, and it was short form, you know. Singles were 3 minutes and absolutely no longer, and artists were famous for 5 minutes, and that was it. And, you know, when the number one record was off the chart, the next week there was another number one record that, you know, would be just as disposable. So Pepper is kind of the first moment, I think, where an artist says, you know, this is our masterpiece. This is important and serious and artistic and should be taken seriously, and that had never happened before.
We talked a couple years ago about your enthusiasm for the Revolver album. What would you say about the creative arc of the Beatles from Revolver to Pepper? How is Pepper markedly different the turns that they were making in Revolver?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest difference between Pepper and Revolver is that after the completion of Revolver, the Beatles stopped touring. And they played their last show in front of an audience in 66 in San Francisco at Candlestick Park. And then they kind of came back to England and they said, you know, that's it. We're done. We're not going to tour anymore. So when they went into the studio to start Pepper, they went in wanting to create a record without the burden of needing to recreate that music on the stage. So that's a really fundamental difference. Like, although they actually played very few songs from Revolver live, when they were making Revolver, they were still thinking that they were going to have to go out on the road and play the stuff on the record in front of people. Whereas with Pepper, they never had that intention. And if anything, they kind of had the opposite intention, which was to create something that could not be played on the stage. And, you know, ironically, now you could do it fairly easily with samplers and laptops and sequencers. But in 1967, it would have been impossible to play Pepper live. And that was really a fundamental idea behind the making of that record. So as a result, unfortunately, I think in a lot of ways, I think Revolver is the superior record, because on Pepper, I think the production trumps the songwriting. You know, what makes Pepper so interesting and so great, to my ears, is more production related than music related. There are great songs on it, but a lot of what makes it really great is the sort of candy coating that they gave the songs. And a lot of the songs on it, I think, are frankly not, well, they're just not nearly as good as the songs on Revolver. You know, if you sit down and just play them on a guitar or on a piano, they don't translate as well without all the gimcrackery, if I can use that word, you know, the gilding that they put on in the studio. That being said, it's an incredible record to listen to just as a studio production and as a piece of electronic music. You know, I mean, virtually every sound on that record is manipulated somehow. There are no sounds where they just put a microphone on something and recorded it. You know, everything was kind of messed with and changed, and that's one of the great things about it.
Do you want to pick a few examples to talk about?
Sure. I mean, I mean, one of the fundamental things on that record that most people are not aware of is
Sorry, would you start that again? Just say one of the fundamental things about on Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, sure. One of the fundamental things on Sgt. Pepper that most people are not aware of in terms of the way it was recorded is that everything was recorded at separate speeds. They kind of figured out around 1966 how to alter the speed of their tape recorders by connecting an oscillator to the motor that controlled the speed of the capstan on the tape recorder. So they started slowing things down and speeding them up, and they did it very subtly. Like they would slow things down just a semitone, which is a slight difference, but it changes the timbre of the sound. So on Sgt. Pepper, it's mostly obvious in vocals. Like if you listen to the vocals on Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, when they were recorded, the tape machine was slowed down. So Lennon actually sang it a half step lower than the song is. And when it's played back, his voice is faster than the other instruments. So his voice has this kind of higher, sort of younger sounding timbre that they use a lot on the record. A lot of things were recorded at alternate speeds. And you can hear it on McCartney's voice in When I'm 64. It tends to make the voice just sound kind of more youthful and otherworldly. But there are even instances like the mono version of She's Leaving Home, the entire mix was sped up like a semitone. So it's faster and higher pitched than the stereo mix.
And another reason why they couldn't perform these in public is that they wouldn't sound the same.
Exactly.
I mean, even vocally.
And I should say that the mono mix of Sgt. Pepper's is the real deal. And it's kind of ironic that this record that everyone praises as this incredible technical achievement and studio achievement, you know, the mono mixes the Beatles were in the room for and they spent hours on and, you know, labored all this love on. And then the stereo mixes were done long after the fact without the Beatles even being there, because in 1967, stereo was this kooky thing that only nerdy hi-fi enthusiasts had. So stereo mixes were a huge afterthought. So the mix that everyone has heard for, you know, 30 years is not the mix that they intended. And when they were making the record, they only monitored in mono. They only had one speaker in the control room. And the mono mix was the mix that they really cared about and lavished all this attention on. And it's sort of my, you know, real musician Beatles fans all have the mono mix, you know, either on bootleg CDs or on old copies of vinyl. But it's kind of my hope that, and there is a rumor that they're going to re-release the album on CD with the mono mix as well as the stereo.
If I put that stereo into my computer and recorded it as a mono file, would that be the mono mix?
No, mono mix is really vastly different, because this is another kind of technically interesting thing about the way that record was made. When they made Sgt. Pepper, the only tape machine that they had to work with was a four-track machine. So they could record four separate parts overdubbed onto the tape and then mix those down to the version that you would buy and listen to. But obviously, as their sort of production needs grew more grandiose, they needed more than four tracks to record on. So what they would do is they would record, and this actually goes back to earlier records, but the process of bouncing, as it's called, reaches kind of its apogee on Sgt. Pepper, where you record three things, or you record four things on one four-track tape, and then you record those four things together down onto the first track of another four-track machine, and then you add three more things. So that enabled them to get seven tracks. Sometimes they would even do that twice, that bouncing, which enabled them to get more and more stuff onto the tape. And in the case of A Day in the Life, they actually had two four-track machines running simultaneously when they mixed it. So they literally would have to line up the tapes so that they would start at the same time and then push the start buttons of the two machines simultaneously and hope that the material on the two tape machines was in sync. And if it wasn't, they would just have to stop and start again and just do it by trial and error. And I think a lot of times it took hours to do those mixes. And, you know, as a result, because they only had four tracks, all the sort of sound effect things and extra effects in Sgt. Pepper were added during mixing. They were flown in from other tape machines. So, like, the, you know, the animal sound effects on Good Morning, Good Morning were not on the tape that the music was recorded on. They were on a separate tape on a separate tape machine, and both those tape machines were fed into a mixer when the mix was being made. So the mono mix and the stereo mix are drastically different because of where the sound effects were faded in and faded out and things like that.
It sounds to me like you have read every scrap of history about the recording of these albums and listened intently over and over again.
Yeah, I have, you know, fairly obsessively. And I mean, what's so amazing is what they were able to do with Sgt. Pepper, given the technology of the time, which was really rudimentary compared with what we have today, you know? I mean, they had to do effects. You know, there's an effect, really common effect on records now called flanging. And, you know, now you literally push a button. You know, you call up a computer program and it just does it automatically. They would have to record a track onto two separate, you know, make two tape recordings of the same track, play them back on two tape machines, and literally have an engineer lean on the flange of one of the other tape machines to slow that tape down slightly to create the time difference that makes the effect happen. You know, all of their effects were kind of created in this weird Rube Goldberg way, because that was the only way to do it, you know.
When were you born?
I was born in 1965.
65, okay. Well, why and when were you, you know, so drawn to a deep study of Beatles recording?
That's a good question. I guess, you know, it happened so early. My attraction to the Beatles happened when I was so young. You know, I almost can't define it. I guess for somebody of my generation, you know, the Beatles were almost like cartoon figures. You know, they had ceased being real people. I didn't grow up when they were famous, or even, you know, they didn't exist as a band when I was a kid. So they were just kind of this, I don't know, I don't even know how to describe it, this kind of abstract phenomenon. And to me, you know, and I said this about Revolver, there's something about their records that they just have this timeless quality. And I guess that's what appeals to me the most. You know, so many people, their associations with music are based on where they were when they heard the music, and the music as kind of a background to their own life, you know. And the incredible thing about the Beatles for me is that I have none of those associations, because they weren't part of my life. You know, by the time I was sort of listening to music, they had ceased to be an entity. And to me, it's just the records themselves. You know, it's not the associations I have with, you know, kissing Mary Lou at the prom while it was playing in the background. It's just the record. Mm-hmm. And the records really hold up, you know. I mean, that being said, to me, the ironic thing about Pepper, you know, Pepper gets lauded with all these accolades about being the greatest rock record ever, and it's always at the top of every list of the 500 best records ever. And or ironically, it's at the top of the worst 500 records ever, you know, but it's always given this sort of special status. To me, it's all the Beatles records, it's really almost the most dated, you know. It's kind of and that's one really beautiful thing about it. It is so of its time, you know. It's like, if you want to know what 1967 was like, listen to that record, and you know, you can pretty much get it, you know. But on the other hand, it hasn't transcended its time, I think, the way that Revolver or even Rubber Soul. You know, to me, Revolver and Abbey Road are much better records than Pepper is, but Pepper gets all of the attention just because, you know, it's so demonstrative of the zeitgeist of that time. And I think that the people who kind of control the culture industry right now are all, you know, they're all baby boomers. So it's kind of like that record always gets foisted upon people as the ultimate record, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that being said, it's an incredible record, but I don't think it's their best record.
Right. You mentioned a couple of tracks, and when you were talking about kind of the studio inventions that were being tried, are there other tracks that you are especially enthusiastic about, just musically? Or
sure, I mean there are two tracks from the Pepper Project that George Martin specifically always talks about, and they're kind of like the best examples of the sort of stuff they did. Strawberry Fields Forever was actually recorded for Sgt. Pepper. It was the first song recorded for Sgt. Pepper. And it wound up being released with Penny Lane as a single before the album came out. But the beginning of the Pepper sessions really is Strawberry Fields Forever. And Strawberry Fields Forever was the finished record that everybody hears is actually two different versions of the song spliced together. So Lennon came in with the song, they recorded this kind of slow, dreamy, pastoral version, and he kind of liked it, but he wanted to try something different. So George Martin wrote an orchestral score for it, and they recorded kind of a darker, stranger, more psychedelic arrangement with backwards drums and trumpets and cellos. And Lennon kind of liked that one, but in his inscrutably flaky way, he kind of came to George Martin and said, well, I like the beginning of, you know, the quiet one, but I like the end of the crazy one, so why don't we put them together? So the songs, unfortunately, were recorded in different keys and in different tempos, you know, and Lennon, of course, just said, oh, I'm sure you can figure it out, and left George Martin and Jeff Emmerich, the engineer, the task of putting them together. So after sort of hours of tinkering, they figured out that if you slowed one down and sped the other up, not only would the keys match, but the tempos would match. So they did that, and they cut the two versions together. And that's the version that you hear. You know, the splice occurs after the second, let me take you down on the, it's right before the word down. And once you know where the splice is and you listen to it, it's incredibly obvious, and you'll never not hear it again. But you know, for years before I knew that, I just listened to it, and I thought of it as this kind of wacky song. But if you know where the splice is and you listen for it, it's incredibly obvious. The instrumentation completely changes. The timbre of the track changes because the speed has changed. The drums completely change. The bass drops out. But I mean, that to me is kind of an incredible technical thing. It's an incredibly weird, almost like music concrete assemblage of two very disparate takes on the same song. And you know, it was a hit single that got played on the radio.
Yeah. And, that was a remarkable, recap of the recording behind it. What's the overall feeling that you get from this record when you hear it? I mean, what do you like about it, outside of the fascination with the recording of it?
Well, to me, the way it was recorded is what makes you feel the way you feel about it. It's this incredibly psychedelic, dreamy, surreal kind of song. And I think the fact that it was assembled electronically and altered in the way it was, really lends itself to that feeling that it sort of conjures up, you know, that kind of acid drenched, you know, distinctly English psychedelic feeling. You know, it's kind of this weird mix of childhood reverie and, you know, adult, psychedelic overindulgence. The incredible thing to me is that, you know, the other side of that single, it was a double A-side single, is Penny Lane. And, you know, Penny Lane is really probably my favorite record of all time. You know, I just never get tired of it. It's like you put it on and just sunshine comes out of your speakers. You know, it is the most positive, good vibe dispensing record I have ever heard in my life. And the fact that, you know, Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane were a 45, were, you know, one single, double A-sided single, is just incredible to me. I mean, it's got to be the greatest single ever released in history. And, of course, the great irony is it was the first Beatles single not to go to number one. It was held out of the number one spot by Please Release Me by Engelbert Humperdinck, which is like one of the great ironies of pop music history.
More about Penny Lane, then. If it's your favorite, there must be all kinds of twists and turns and appreciation for the lyricism.
Yeah, I think, you know, Penny Lane is just so straightforward. It's so straightforwardly sunny. And one kind of interesting fact about a lot of the tunes on Pepper were recorded, they weren't recorded with a band playing in the room together. They were kind of assembled, you know. By that time, the Beatles were so used to overdubbing and using the studio as an instrument, the whole notion of capturing a performance of the band was kind of out the window. So Penny Lane was actually constructed, the first thing they recorded was just Paul singing and playing it on the piano. And then everything else was added after the fact. So Ringo was actually playing drums, you know, a day later to just Paul playing the piano on tape already, which is a very sort of backwards way to do it. Usually, certainly if you're going to record things separately, you do the drums first. But Penny Lane was kind of constructed from the piano up. But I you know, it just has that classic McCartney thing where the construction is strange, but it doesn't feel strange, and it goes from a major to a minor key. You know, if I play it, can you hear that? You know, if I play it on the piano, you know, the chords, it's in B major, the verse, and then it just goes to B minor. You know, which is just a strange, and then the chorus, it modulates down to A major. Course is an A, you know, which it's just unexpected, but very pleasing, and because the chorus is an A, when you get back to the verse, you feel like it goes back up to B, so you get this nice, you're modulating up, you feel like you're modulating up in key every time you go to a verse, and then at the end the chorus modulates up to B. So it's just it just feels positive, you know. And then of course the use of the sort of classical instrumentation and the piccolo trumpet, which unfortunately became this sort of huge cliche of 60s psychedelic music, you know, throwing in the like Baroque trumpet solo or, you know, the Baroque instrumentation. But, you know, just the use of that is so novel and just the mix of those two things. You know, it's really postmodern in its highest phase. You know, it's just saying we can pick and choose these kind of genre elements from any period and any time and any style and mix them together to get this new thing. And, you know, I mean, Penny Lane, it's like the backbeat of Chuck Berry with the piccolo trumpet of J.S. Bach, you know, mixed together, and it just totally works, you know. And then it's got this horn chart that's almost like Burt Bacharach or, you know, Herb Albert kind of horn chart under the choruses, and it's got, you know, these beautiful high piccolo, you know, the chart, the George Martin chart for it is just incredible. It's just everything in that song works for me.
Will your mic have picked up your piano playing there pretty well?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, great. That's a nice illustration there. And then the other thing before we leave that is that, and I'm not putting words in your mouth, but if you want to comment on it, fine, is that I think beginning with maybe Paperback Writer, you know, McCartney is launching deeply into a sort of cinematic storytelling that, you know, comes through in like She's Leaving Home, but it also strikes me that Penny Lane is, you know, these little vignettes of, you know, what kind of psychedelic vignettes, you know, they're sort of non sequiturs in some ways, but that is a change for his writing. I mean, he's in the middle of something that is a shift for him, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, his writing just gets, the period of, I'd say, 66 and 67 is really just the peak. He's just writing. It's incredible, the songs he's writing, Paul is writing, and how great they are and how they've sort of held up, you know. But another thing I would really say that is a really fundamental thing on Pepper is Paul's bass playing. And, you know, it really comes to the fore on Revolver, but on Pepper, it actually got to the point where, you know, as I said earlier, they only had four tracks to record onto. They could only have four separate elements on their tape. And when they got to Pepper, they would literally always leave one open at the end for the bass, which is a big deal. Like, they wanted the bass to have its own track and have a special prominence on every song. And when Emmerich was mixing the record, he literally used the meters on the mixing board to make sure that the bass was as loud as the lead vocal, so that the two loudest things on the record were the vocal and the bass. And if you read Jeff Emmerich's autobiography, he talks about when they were cutting Pepper, basically they would finish a song, leave a track open for the bass, everyone would go home except him and McCartney, and they would spend hours, you know, just on the bass tracks, literally punching in every note so that the bass tracks were just kind of perfect. And if you listen to that record and listen to the bass playing on it, you know, the bass playing is almost a separate melody. If you get tired of the song itself, you can delve deeper into the song and just listen to the melody on the bass, because it's usually almost as good as the melody that's being sung.
What's the best example of that?
I love the bass playing on Getting Better. If you listen to the bass playing on Getting Better, I should have plugged in a bass because I could play it for you. But the bass on the first chorus, there's just kind of this ascending bass line that just kind of goes up the scale. But then the bass changes on the second chorus, and he starts to play a counter melody to the melody that's being sung. And it's really interesting because it has – usually, you know, when you try and put a bass part together, you're basing it on what the drummer is playing on the kick drum. You want the bass to be playing notes at the same time as the kick drum is playing. And on Getting Better, that idea gets thrown out the window, and it's just kind of another melodic element that's playing under the singing. And it's really exceptional, the bass playing.
Well, this is a very rich conversation. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but before I ask you for a couple of comments on Paul Simon, were there some things that were kind of lodged in your head or that you jotted
down?
Yeah,
I just one thing I wanted to say, because you asked for specific musical things.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about just Good Morning. There's a time signature thing. You know, Lennon. I'll say again, Lennon and McCartney, they have this incredible ability to write things that, if you're a musician and you look at them, are very weird, but they don't feel weird. And Lennon does that on Good Morning, Good Morning. You know, most songs are in one time signature, so there's sort of four beats in a measure or three beats in a measure. So, you know, Penny Lane is four beats in a measure. It's just one, two, three, four. Sorry. Doing the wrong key. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, it's just four throughout the entire song. But in Good Morning, Good Morning, and I can actually call it up, the time signature just constantly changes. Let's show you. It starts in four of the... So this is in four, one, two, three, four, one, two. But the verse is completely different. So the verse is one, two, three, one, two, three, four, five, one, two, one, two, three, one, two, three, four, five, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, five, one, two, three, four, one, two, three. So you have bars of four, bars of three, bars of two, bars of five. All after one another. I mean, it's incredibly weird.
Where does that come from, then, you think?
I don't know. You know, I think Lennon just had this innate sense of where he wanted the song to go. And again, you know, when you listen to it, it doesn't sound that strange. You know, you can kind of immediately feel where it's going. And if anything, the kind of changes in time signature make it a little more interesting. You know, it's like the path is a little more meandering and holds your interest a little more. But if you're a musician and you're sitting down and you're trying to figure it out, you know, it's incredibly weird. You know, it's, and of course, you know, he wasn't thinking that way. He wasn't saying, oh, I'm going to do a bar five, then a bar three, then a bar two. You know, he just sat down and started singing this melody, and that's how it came out, you know, I assume.
And this must be another case where George Martin putting the horn chart together or something. I mean, who's responsible for the heavy horn?
That would be George Martin, you know, but I'm sure, you know, that's the thing where George Martin sits down and he has to write the chart out for the horn players. And he says, oh, my God, you know, look at all these time changes, you know. I mean, the unfortunate thing is, and this is something that has to be said about Peppers, that it kind of spawned a host of terrible imitators, you know, the same way that, like, the Allman Brothers ultimately gave us 38 Special. You know, Sgt. Pepper and the whole sort of idea of the concept album, you know, you got sort of great things like Tommy by The Who or SF Sorrow by The Pretty Things, but then it kind of blossomed into the huge excesses of the prog era, where you have bands that are doing, you know, time changes and key changes just kind of for the sake of showing that they can do it, and you get these, you know, LP long suites and just kind of a much higher level of pretension, which, you know, ultimately the punk movement deflated. But, you know, Pepper spawned a huge trajectory in pop music that lasts to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yep.